Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Binal of BinalofAmerica.com with another edition of Binal of America Audio. It is April 22nd, 2006. This week, we have for you an amazing guest, Andre Eglishon. Andre Eglishon was on the short list of guests I wanted on Binal of America Audio when I started the show back in September. I had just read his book, Thieves in the Temple, and I was just dying to have him on the show. We finally connected last week. In the meantime, Andre has released a second book entitled Where the Right Went Wrong on National Security and the Left Too, and I had the opportunity to read that in the last month or so, so we got a chance to talk about both books in this interview. And I'm just tremendously excited about bringing Andre Eglishon to Binal of America Audio. I'm a huge fan of his work. We're discussing the national security state, national security apparatus, National Security Council, whatever you want to call it. It is this cloak of national security that is used as the rationalization for a lot of shady maneuverings going on over the last 60-plus years here in America and all over the world. We're going to be discussing that. We also dip into some of the themes and elements of Thieves in the Temple as well. If you haven't heard Andre Eglishon before, you're in for a real treat. Let me give you a little bit of background on him. Andre Eglishon is an alumnus of Florida A&M University in both music and political science. He is a successful entrepreneur and the talk radio host of The Andre Eglishon Show, syndicated nationally and heard on the Information Radio Network and live on the internet at www.inforadionet.com. He's the author of Thieves in the Temple and the only known African-American to publish a book on the Federal Reserve System. Andre has published numerous papers on subjects ranging from science to religion and is also rapidly becoming a red-hot commodity on the lecture circuit. He's also the author of the new book, Where the Right Went Wrong on National Security, and The Left Too. You can find out more information on Andre Eglishon at www.talktoandre.com, TalkToAndre.com. Check it out, that's his website. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll with this week's edition of Binal of America Audio. Andre Eglishon, Where the Right Went Wrong on National Security and the Left Too. This episode was recorded on April 14th, 2006. Andre Eglishon on Binal of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Binal of America Audio. My guest this week is Andre Eglishon. Many of you may know him for his fantastic book, Thieves in the Temple, America Under the Federal Reserve System. He's also got a new book out, and that's what we're going to be talking about this week. And that is Where the Right Went Wrong on National Security and the Left Too. His website is talktoandre.com, and you can also hear him Monday to Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time, live on the internet on the Information Radio Network, and the website for that is www.inforadionet.com. Welcome to the show, Andre.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we dive into Where the Right Went Wrong, why don't you give me a little background how you came into this whole field and everything like that?
Well, I've studied the Federal Reserve System for quite some time, about 10 years. I've studied our national security policies in a historical context for about the same amount of time. And I consider myself a historian. And in understanding the historical progression of privately owned central banks and the corporations that grown up around them, I just felt that I had to throw my 2 cents into the pie. I know that there are a number of books that have been written about the Federal Reserve, very good books. And my book, Thieves in the Temple, tries to pick up where many of these books left off. And the main idea that I want people to understand is beyond the simple anatomy of the Federal Reserve System and its physiology early on, the Federal Reserve System has morphed into a institution which is run by a group of frantic men trying to maintain the only thing that's holding the world's economy together right now, which is confidence in the system. So I decided to put my thoughts down on paper for that and publish it in a book. Just to let people know that today the Federal Reserve is presiding over an economic environment which is can only be described as beastly in nature, totally untamable. We're caught in the grips of a maligned, self-cannibalizing global economic system right now. And as I said, the Fed's Board of Governors are frantically trying to maintain enough confidence in the system so as to maintain stability in not only our markets, but in the world markets that are affected by Fed policy. My second book, Where the Right Went Wrong on National Security, is an attempt to address what I feel has been a drive towards an imperial presidency in America, and the utilization by various administrations, primarily on the right, but some on the left as well, of the National Security Act and its protocols to establish that imperial presidency in the United States of America. What started out in 1947 with the passage of the National Security Act, the National Security Council, as a civilian advisory committee to presidents, has today morphed into a command post for all kinds of illegal covert black operations which have been backdoored out of various White Houses, both on the right and on the left, since the establishment of the National Security State in 1947. So I felt that it was important to address national security and what has been the byproducts of U.S. national security policy as well as U.S. presidential policies on strategic petroleum reserves, as many of these corporations operating in the defense sector have been prime beneficiaries of the Federal Reserve's monetary policy, and what has been, in my opinion, the adverse effect on pretty much every living thing on this planet. So I think these two books really will give the reader a thorough background in the compromises that the American people have made, first of all, in outsourcing and privatizing our monetary policy, and secondly, in allowing the implementation of national security strategies of the true security of the country, but to facilitate the agenda of multinational corporations, primarily in the defense sector, in the name of national security.
Yeah. Now, do you think the fact that the National Security Council, the National Security Agency, it was secret for so long, you couldn't even tell anybody about it, that it even existed, that sort of goes hand in hand with the anonymity of the bankers that you stress in Thieves in the Temple, right?
That is correct. Anonymity is their most cherished asset, both of the military strategists as well as of the bankers. The international bankers cherish their anonymity. It is the loss of the anonymity which can send the markets in a tizzy. Brokerage, individuals working in the brokerage industry and the accounting industry and pretty much every professional on Wall Street has paid very close attention to the physical posture of various Fed chairmen, particularly Alan Greenspan. I mean, if he carried his briefcase in a certain hand, it would send signals. So, you know, they try to maintain anonymity to avoid sending the wrong signals to the market and thereby undermine the glue that's holding this whole thing together, which is the confidence of the world that the dollar is still sound because the United States is still the dominant economic and political and military force in the world. However, it's a house of cards, and because the dollar's hegemony is ensured simply by nothing but that confidence. I mean, the dollar is in serious jeopardy right now of the loss of its hegemony. As a matter of fact, Tony Blair said that in 2012, the dollar will no longer be the world's reserve currency. So the central bankers want to maintain the control of the rate, pace, and sequence of the transference of the dollar's hegemony, its status as a reserve currency, into some other currency by that particular time.
Yeah. And now, the NSC and the NSA, I kind of use them interchangeably. I hope that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
They were created in 1947, like you said. This was right about in the wake of as these guys in Project Paperclip were being brought to America. do you think the importation of these war criminals and pretty much German mind benders and what have you, think the importation of these guys brought their ethics and their that whole mindset over to America?
I think that the mindset pretty much existed here in America because it was Wall Street which financed the rise of Adolf Hitler. And to just give the listeners a brief overview of the what, when, where's, and why's of Operation Paperclip, you cannot really have that without understanding that Nazism was largely a Wall Street financed project. And President Kennedy, at the time Hitler was beginning to rise to power, even wrote a book about it. It's called Why England Slept. And there were those here in the United States that felt that capitalism and fascism could peacefully coexist. Well, naturally, you know, enemies are financed. Empires don't rise by happenstance. They are financed. They are set up for the purpose of exploitation of the population in the guise of economic development. And this has been a dynamic which has been ongoing in our country since the establishment of privately owned central banks and since this drive towards internationalism really began to pick up pace shortly after the turn of the 20th century with the establishment of the Federal Reserve. So yeah, I do believe that the mindset, to answer your question, of his scientists and the whole Nazi mental framework was already at play here in the United States.
Yeah. Okay, now in the book you discuss Operation Ajax, which was an NSC operation in Iran that you say is pretty much the source of the angst against America in Iran, or at least was the start of this angst, you think. So why don't you talk about Operation Ajax, because a lot of people in America never even heard of it.
You know, we could talk about Operation Ajax, we could talk about Operation Paperclip, Food Belt. I'd like to talk about them all. Operation Ajax was the code name for the policy of regime change in Iran back in 1953. Iran was under the rulership of a very popularly perceived president in Iran at that particular time. His name was Mohammad Mossadegh. And what happened was the right-wing abuse of power under the national security state apparatus created this seminal event in the Middle East, wherein they did exactly that. They implemented regime change in Iran. The United States and Great Britain jointly worked together in a covert operation called Operation Ajax in 1953. Now, in 1950-51, they tried to get Truman to sign off on this regime change operation, but in approaching an election year, he knew that if the thing backfired, it would be a death knell to the Democratic Party. Eisenhower was elected, and he signed off on it. Truman neglected to do so for political reasons. Truman was a very, very careful politician. I mean, during the period, the Operation Paperclip period prior to that, when the newly created Central Intelligence Agency wanted to bring in Nazi war criminals and put them to work in the defense sector, particularly in the biological and chemical weapons area and the aerospace area, when they wanted to put these guys to work, Truman refused to allow these individuals to be brought into the country if it were found that they, you know, were guilty of war crimes, even before Nuremberg. And so Truman told him, look, you know, I will only allow those individuals who don't have that stuff in the dossiers to come into the United States. So what happened was the CIA got together and they began sanitizing the dossiers. And then they brought in people like Wernher von Braun, made him the head of NASA, and others. Even Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon, was brought into the United States. And we used these Nazi assets. They were the spoils of the war. They were the spoils of World War II to leverage our strategic advantage against the Soviet Union, because the Nazi intelligence apparatus under Reinhard Gehlen had amassed a wealth of information on the Soviets, and we wanted to have them. They were the prime spoils of the war, and we achieved that goal at that particular time. So most Americans don't know that many of the individuals who we were fighting just months prior to them being brought into the United States were now assets of the United States intelligence community. So Truman was very careful in this regard. He did not want to get involved in regime change in Iran. As I said, Eisenhower signed off on it. And the reason why they wanted to get rid of Mossadegh was allegedly because the man was a communist. You see, after they established the Soviet Union of Socialist Republics in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution, it became the antithetical political ideology to capitalism. It became the best enemy that money can buy. Defense contractors grew extremely wealthy, and arguably jobs were created. Houses were bought here in the United States. An economy was built around this antagonism between the United States and the Soviet Union. So what happened was, anybody who was a communist or who was labeled a communist during the Great Red Scare period, if you saw the movie Good Night and Good Luck, it talks about Edward R. Murrow in his fight against McCarthy and the branding of individuals in our society arbitrarily as being communists.
Yeah.
Anybody who was labeled a communist was automatically deemed a national security threat to the United States. And there was this, as I said, this antithetical dynamic that was established by the powers of Wall Street to the United States, and thereby it offered the justification when they labeled Mohammad Mossadegh a communist for U.S. military action in the name of national security. Well, of course, Mossadegh was not a communist. He had no communists in his camp whatsoever. As a matter of fact, one student, Mansour Fahong, who was in Iran at that particular time, ended up telling Bill Moyers that he absolutely had no communists in his camp. So by them labeling him a communist, it justified this covert action against him. His only crime was that he nationalized oil fields that were owned by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. In other words, the British had went in there, and they had privatized the oil fields of Iran in the early 1950s. And when Mossadegh was elected, he was a nationalist, he was a popularist, and naturally following the ideological pursuits of a nationalist leader, he sought a greater share of the profits from his own natural resources, which is this vast Iranian oil reserve.
Yeah.
And when he nationalized those oil fields and took them back from the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which would later on become BP, British Petroleum, it drew the indignation of the oil cartels, and they wanted him out. And they simply labeled him a communist. Eisenhower signed off on the covert op. A proxy coup was implemented by financing dissidents in the streets, similar to what the United States is doing in Iran right now, with the $70 million psychological operation, which is being carried out by the neo-realists in Washington to create enough dissent, enough antagonism, enough support for democratic reform in Iran to overthrow the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. They did that in 1953 against the government of Mohammad Mossadegh, and the man was overthrown. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of innocent Iranians had their lives overturned,
yeah,
turned topsy-turvy. There was murder, death, and intimidation in the streets, and the man was ran out of power. Now, it's not very difficult to draw a line from the overthrow of the Mossadegh government in 1953 and the subversion of democracy at that particular time, and not the support of democracy by the United States, which professes today to be a purveyor of democracy. It was that asphyxiation of democracy in Iran at that particular time, which was the beginning of the line that we can draw through the Khomeini Revolution, through the taking of the hostages all the way down through the rise of the Iraq-Iran war, and down to where we are today in this this very tenuous position in dealing with the Iranian government and the drive towards acquiring nuclear technology.
Yeah. See, a lot of people in America probably have never even heard of what went on there, back with all Operation Ajax, right?
No, they're not. The average person is totally unaware of what took place at that particular time. I mean, the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh was a very dramatic and pivotal period in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And it's just another example of the subversion of the democratic ideals for which America, you know, purports to stand. I mean, rather than using, you know, honesty and statesmanship and diplomacy, too often imperial hubris has been the underscoring factor in U.S. foreign policy. Rather than using a true internationalist approach and sitting down and negotiating and diplomatically trying to steer governments into being facilitators with the United States and advancing America's interests abroad, we will invoke the national security imperative, and we will pretty much bring these countries our desired policy machinations through military force in the name of national security. And whenever we do this, invariably, we do nothing more than generate more anti-Americanism.
Yep.
We generate a image of America around the world, which is extremely negative and extremely problematic for future foreign policy objectives. So at some point, we're going to have to begin to return to the type of statesmanship that we, you know, used to employ around the world.
Yeah.
We've got to stop being so abrasive in terms of our interjections and our dabbling in other people's affairs, because it does have an adverse effect on we, the people of the United States of America, because the animus of the Iranian people now is actually going beyond a disdain for our elected officials. They hate all Americans. And we see the self-same thing occurring with the elements of Al-Qaeda, the Mujahideen. These are all individuals who we have had very deceptive diplomatic engagement with in the past, and now their hatred is towards the American people and not just our elected leaders. So in the name of national security, ironically, we make our security situation far more vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the problems, like you said, with the national security apparatus is that it allows for sort of a loophole of the war powers away from Congress. If you just blanket something in the term of a national security, then they can sort of go subversive and do things that otherwise previously the Congress would have had to intervene with, right?
Absolutely. The National Security Act, in my opinion, should be revisited, because I do believe that these national security lawyers have argued, and argued successfully, to expand presidential powers. And this is something that Vice President Cheney said that he very much wants to see happen. He wants to see an expansion of presidential power, particularly in the name of national security. So you're absolutely right. It has been a cloak for various illegal, anti-constitutional, anti-congressional, and anti-populist policies, which have been fomented by various right-wing and a few left-wing White Houses since 1947. In other words, when a president invokes national security, then the Constitution becomes irrelevant, the will of Congress becomes irrelevant, and the will of the American people become totally irrelevant. The UN becomes irrelevant. The popular perceptions of the United States by our allies becomes irrelevant. Previous treaties that America has entered into become irrelevant. And the only relevance at play is a narrow set of policies that are prescribed within the National Security Council and the White House. And, you know, we've seen time and time again the folly in allowing this imperial power to be wielded by these presidents.
All right, and in the book you talk about two different operations other than Operation Ajax. We talk about a bunch of them anyway, but Operation Success, which was a project down in Guatemala where they interfered there, and Project Fubelt, which was in Chile. Now, those are just like two examples of many instances where this NSA has, NSC, CIA, shadowy stuff has gone on, or are those just like the two worst, or what do you think?
Well, these are, I just simply chose some glaring examples of where constitutional law has been pretty much disregarded, and various administrations, various elected leaders outside of the executive administration in Washington have been compromised. These are very stark examples, and I feel that these are examples of the violation of the notion of democracy, the violation of the notion of freedom in the name of national security by the United States, that have cost us, from a regional perspective, more strategic capital than what they were worth. So I tried to choose some prime examples.
Yeah.
Operation Success in Guatemala, Operation Fubelt in Chile, and Operation Ajax in Iran. And I try to lead the readers without taking them through the entire history of everything that we've done in the name of national security. It'd take a volume of books to do that.
Yeah.
I just try to give a few examples to drive home the point that in the name of national security, what we are witnessing in America is the rise of an imperial presidency, and it's something that the founding fathers of the United States, although they were morally bankrupt, they were wise enough not to vest that kind of power in any one branch of the government. All three branches of the government are supposed to be co-equal, and let me throw in another one. We the people, along with the press, the fourth estate in America, are also, in my opinion, at the very least co-equal. Equal to the three branches of our government, executive, legislative, and judicial. In fact, they do work for us.
Yeah. And in the book, you spent a lot of time on the Iran-Contra scandal. Do you think this is an instance where the lid was blown off the whole secret game going on, and at that point, people kind of saw for the first time what was really going on?
Exactly. The Iran-Contra hearings exposed in a very compelling way, the way in which the national security apparatus was totally out of control in the country at that particular time. And when Ronald Reagan, I mean, numerous lies were told during that affair. Everything happened unimaginable at that particular time, from drug running in the United States, which violated the Bolin Amendment as was passed by Congress. And the lessons of 1986 are lessons that I think for the first time began to sink in. We missed the lessons of 1953, in my opinion. We missed the lessons of 1954. John Kennedy surely learned the lessons of 1961 with the Bay of Pigs. But we missed those lessons, in my opinion. And in 1986, I think for the first time, people began to understand that, you know, hey, this national security thing is now, you know, it's the epicenter of all kinds of dark, illegal, covert operations which have been backdoored out of these White Houses. As I said, including drug running.
Yeah.
I remember back on October 7th in 1994. Senior White House correspondent Sarah McClendon questioned Bill Clinton about some drug running activities that were being done in the state of Arkansas at that particular time by an organization called the Enterprise, which was set up and run by Oliver North, Albert Hakim, and Richard Secord during the Reagan years. It was the organization that was set up to pretty much do an in-run around Congress and provide the funding for the Contra War in Nicaragua. And she cornered him, and she asked him in public about, you know, these activities that were taking place in a small airfield in Arkansas in the little town of Mena. And this is an airstrip where normally Cessnas would take off and land. And Clinton became governor promising to bring economic development to Arkansas. So when they saw these larger aircraft at this base, most people at that time assumed that, well, our governor's making good on his pledge to bring economic development to Arkansas. Little did they know at that particular time that MENA was being used as a CIA staging ground for a drug running operation.
Yeah.
So I want to quote to you the question that Sarah McClendon asked President Clinton at that particular time. She said, quote, "Sir, the Republicans are trying to blame you for the existence of a small base at MENA, Arkansas. The base was set up by George Bush and Oliver North and the CIA to help the Iran-Contras. And they brought in plane load after plane load of cocaine there for sale in the United States. And then they took the money and they bought weapons and took them back to the Contras. All of this was illegal under the Boland Act. But tell me, did they tell you that this had to be in existence because of national security?" Close quote. So now there, she's pointing out how that this drug running operation was, you know, possibly being conducted in the name of national security. Now, in looking at Clinton in that video, you can see that he was definitely bothered.
Yeah.
That this lady would ask him, you know, a question that was so sensitive to national security.
Mm-hmm.
And Clinton paused for a moment and he answered her. He said, quote, "Well, let me answer the question. No, they didn't tell me anything about it. They didn't say anything to me about it. The airport in question and all the events in question were the subject of state and federal inquiries, and it was found primarily a matter for federal jurisdiction. The state really had next to nothing to do with it. The local prosecutor did conduct an investigation based on what was in the jurisdiction of state law. The rest of it was under the jurisdiction of the United States attorneys appointed successively by previous administrations. We had nothing, zero to do with it, and everybody who's ever looked into it knows that." Now, and that's a close quote.
Okay.
Now, there are some problems with what President Clinton had to say. Well, then Governor Clinton at that time had to say. First of all, he said that the state and local prosecutor did conduct an investigation based upon what was in the jurisdiction of the state law. Well, the local prosecutor was a man by the name of Charles Black, and according to him, he went to then Governor Clinton asking him for money because he knew that rural Polk, Arkansas didn't have the funding necessary in order to be able to go up against the CIA. So he went to Governor Clinton and he asked him for $20,000 to fund the investigation. And Clinton responded to him that he'd get a man on it and that he would report back to him. Well, nobody ever got back with Charles Black, and neither did he get the $20,000. So Clinton's statement that the state had next to nothing to do with it was absolutely correct. They had nothing to do with an investigation of the shadowy activities of the Reagan-Bush White House, compromising his governorship, compromising his office, and compromising the sovereignty of the state of Arkansas by allowing this illegal drug-running operation to take place in Arkansas. And I got to tell you, that's why cocaine exploded on the streets in the late 1990s here in the United States, just as heroin exploded on the United States streets during the Vietnam War, because the CIA began working with the Hmong tribesmen in South Vietnam, and we would get intelligence from them in exchange. You know, we would take their heroin and it would be sold here on the streets of the United States.
Yeah.
So these are the kinds of activities, these are the kinds of illegal covert activities that are conducted in the name of national security. And they have nothing to do, as a matter of fact, they compromise our security more than they actually shore up or bolster our national security. And that particular example is a glaring example of where the right went wrong on national security and the left at the same time, too.
Exactly.
And do you think the Iran-Contra scandal slowed down this national security apparatus, or did they just sort of find a way to do it more secretive?
Well, I think that when you look at the National Security Council of George Herbert Walker Bush, you can see that he took a far more collegial approach to it than Ronald Reagan did. And I think that, yes, it forced some sobriety temporarily. You can see that when the first President Bush went up against Saddam Hussein in Kuwait. And there were those individuals at that particular time of the neoconservative stripe that was pushing Herbert Walker Bush, I don't want to get him mixed up with his grandfather, Herbert Walker Bush. They were pushing him at that particular time to go ahead and remove Saddam from office. Let's go ahead and take Baghdad. And at that particular time, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney and President George Herbert Walker Bush chose not to do that because, number one, that was not the mandate from the UN. Number two, they understood that regime change would cost the American people far more monetarily. So they did not go beyond the immediate mission, which was running Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. So we could see some sobriety in American foreign policy as a result of the Iran-Contra affair gathering so much media attention, gathering so much controversy, and I just find it amazing that, you know, more people did not end up in trouble behind that other than Poindexter and a few others that ended up getting in a lot of trouble at that particular time. If you ask me, when Ronald Reagan lied to the American people saying that, no, we did not sell arms for hostages, and knowing full well that we did sell arms for hostages, and he came back a few days later and had to admit that on national television and say, yes, we did sell arms for hostages, he was lying. And the president should have been held to account for that.
Yeah.
He also said that Israel was not involved in selling arms to the Iranians, but in fact, Israel was involved with selling arms to the Iranians at that particular time, and that was admitted to by Ed Meese in a press conference only a couple days after Ronald Reagan made that statement. So, you know, the administration was practicing the art of prevarication in order to facilitate this illegal goal of funding the Contras. As a matter of fact, Ronald Reagan even described himself as being a Contra. You know, he said the Contras are freedom fighters, and he said, you know, I guess that makes me a Contra too.
And now, like we're talking about how there might have been a sobriety after Iran-Contra, but it seems like that sobriety is pretty much gone now when this war on terror has begun. Is that what you, do you agree with that statement, that you know, the whole national security blanket has, you know, come out of the crawl space, if you will, and is used pretty frequently now in the war on terror?
Well, you know, a lot has been written about the events of September 11. I mean, there is a cottage industry on those events right now. A lot of brave Americans have challenged the official forensic analysis that the government has offered up about the anatomy and the physiology of those attacks of that day.
Yeah.
And they've offered opposing theories to the government's theory. And that's all we're going to have is theories based on, you know, on September 11th, simply because rather than cordoning off the World Trade Center site and allowing scientists to go in there and to forensically examine the steel and to see how that for the first time in my awareness of the history of steel-constructed buildings, buildings could collapse as a result of fire like that.
Yeah.
So alternative theories have been brought forth to rebut the government's pancake theory. And the president used the attacks of September 11th as a justification for this preemptive and unilateral military action currently underway in Iraq. So a lot has been written about it, and I felt that I need to write about it as well, because here again is another example, in my opinion, of where the right has gone wrong on national security, and everybody on the left that voted for this this action in Iraq, they went wrong on national security at that time as well. I think the country was swept up in a fever of patriotic one-upmanship, and wherein politicians on the left wanted to try to out-patriot the politicians on the right, and it played into the hands of the neocons and the PNACers, those proponents of the Project for the New American Century, who had prescribed regime change in Iraq even before President Bush was elected president. I think it played well into their hands. Consequently, we went to war in Iraq. And the ensuing series of blunders, missteps, miscalculations, errors, mistakes that have occurred since that particular time are epic in scale, and I think that they will definitely sullen the reputation and the legacy of this particular president, the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President, pretty much the former Secretary of State Colin Powell, our current Secretary of State, and Condoleezza Rice, and her actions as National Security Advisor in the first administration of George W. Bush, as well as our current National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley. I mean, their reputations, in my opinion, their legacy is going to be a very bad legacy as a result of this ill-advised and not very well thought out action that's underway in Iraq right now. It's just another example where the right is not wrong on national security.